That is and was perceived by Augustus as a contravention of the Aeneid, to say this stuff, all of this Roman duty stuff, is pretty much, yeah, right. Let's look at what's really going on around here, okay? Ovid would fit in quite comfortably, given a chance to learn the language, in any of the great cities of the world today. He is urbane. He is urban to the tips of his toes. He likes the good life. Pretty women, fine food and drink, luxury, good entertainment, the best stuff. He's the kind of person who thinks the world consists of L.A., New York, London, Paris, and that's it. Maybe some tropical islands sometimes. The kind of person who would think that to land in the middle of the country would be the equivalent of a death sentence. He is totally sophisticated, suave, skeptical. He doesn't take these stories seriously. Most of the metamorphosis is given over to a retelling of the old myths, which Ovid finds charming and amusing, but sure doesn't find theologically freighted. He does talk at the very end about his hope of personally metamorphosing into the fame, the permanent fame, that his book will give him, as indeed it has. He talks, as was good politics to talk, about the metamorphosis of Julius Caesar into a god. But for most of the time, he suggests that there's nothing going on but what's here and now, and hey, let's enjoy it. He wrote other books on how to fall in love or get people to fall in love with you. And also, since falling in love with other people is such a pain and makes you so unhappy, how to fall out of love. He wrote a little poem on makeup. He is obviously a profoundly serious and committed guy. Quite the contrary. In some sense, he really, really is. But he is a person who adopts a pose of being a dandy, a dilettante, set apart. You can think of somebody, I suppose, like Oscar Wilde a century and a bit ago. His lack of caring, which is sort of institutionalized or enshrined in his poetry, is a sign of sophistication. Augustus, as you might imagine, could not stand him, all the more so since he was in a circle with one of Augustus's female relatives, who to Augustus's horror had been living, so he discovered, a life of lurid and exciting sexual adventures. And as a result of that, and as a result of the general bad example that he set, Ovid was finally exiled to the Black Sea, where he wrote poems about how crummy it was to be at the Black Sea. And this is one I haven't had the chance to read, but I'd like to. One of the few things that he found enjoyable to do there, about deep sea fishing in the Black Sea. And there, in exile, he died. So you have a kind of thesis and antithesis structure with the virtues of Rome on parade in Virgil, but also a skeptical, satirical vision of those virtues on parade in Ovid, in a work, which was cherished and celebrated for its terrific stories by not only the rest of antiquity, but Christian Europe, which allegorized his stories into, most implausibly, stories about the life of Jesus often. You should see it. It's amazing how this works. And which also made, because it was so entertaining and because the Latin's not very difficult, which also made of Ovid's Metamorphoses a school text, so that writers for generations and generations, hundreds and hundreds of years to come, cut their literary teeth on Ovid. And in that sense, he's just seeped into the cultural tradition. And as far as that goes, there are certainly no lack of urbane, pleasure-loving, skeptical, smart, good-natured people around in Western culture even still. It would be too much to say that they are responding to Ovid's example. Rather, it would be more accurate, I think, to say that Ovid, in being that way, in writing from that perspective, exemplified a permanent aspect of human nature, which we pretend to disapprove of and may disapprove of to some extent, but which is always with us and which gives us, in this often dreary world, a lot of delight and pleasure even so. On that note, virtue, duty, and their pleasure-loving antitheses will conclude our discussion of Rome and move on in our next lecture to the birth of Christianity, which in its structure and in its origins and in its subsequent history bespeaks the interaction of Hebrews, Greeks, and Romans at every turn and is the primary channel in which the culture of antiquity was transmitted to the Middle Ages and hence, finally, to us.
This ends Lecture 11.